Welcome back to Interventions, the Intellectual History Podcast. My name is Michael Kredovich.
My name is Charlotte Johann.
And before we get to today's guest, I want to introduce my co-host. Returning listeners will recognize the voice of Charlotte from her time as a convener of Interventions. Back then, she was a PhD candidate in the Faculty of History here at Cambridge. Now a junior research fellow at Churchill College, she is writing a history of legal pluralism in 19th century Germany. Welcome back, Charlotte. I'm very glad that you could join me in the studio today to interview our guest, Dr. Michael Sonnenscher.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back. I've missed podcasting, but it's nice to know that Interventions is in good hands now. Michael Sonnenscher's academic career began with a teaching appointment at Middlesex Polytechnic, and in 1988 he became a fellow of King's College Cambridge, where he then directed studies in history until 2014. He has published widely on the history of political thought, particularly in France, on the origins of political economy and on the philosophy of history. He is the author most recently of two books, Capitalism, The Story Behind the World, and After Kant, The Romans, The Germans, and The Moderns in the History of Political Thought, both with Princeton. Few historians know as much about 18th century France as Mike, and we're delighted that he could sit down with us today. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I will try to answer your questions as helpfully as I can manage.
Let's start with a question in the way of introduction. You arrived in England in 1966 and were soon enrolled as an undergraduate at the University of Warwick, where you joined E.P. Thompson's course on industrialization. But you did not become a social historian. Later, in 1988, you arrived at Cambridge, where Richard Tuck and István Hont were already established, but you did not become a political theorist. You became, I would say, a historian whose primary aim has been to bring a full and precise analytical vocabulary to bear on your subject. Your terms are recognisably, but not strictly, political, and your subject has been the forgotten parts of 18th century French history, starting with the life of the urban trades. Mike, would you introduce first the key terms about which you have sought to be precise, and second, the main parts of French history that you have tried to help us remember?
Well, it's been a kind of moving target. So at a certain point, I was interested in the urban trades of 18th century France, and then things happened, partly because my interests had been for a very long time oriented towards thinking about politics and political ideas, because I come from Zimbabwe, and it was hard to avoid thinking about politics and political ideas in that particular context. But the things that I would say came to my attention, and which I think I managed to indicate were worth thinking about. I can think of three to start off with. One is the concept of representation and the degree to which some years ago I noticed that representation had as much to do with inheritance and Roman law as it might do with politics or elections or all the things that we might usually associate with the idea of representative government and political representation. There was once in the 16th, 17th and 18th century a way of thinking about the royal succession which had to do with the idea of representation, in which one person, usually male, was taken to be the representative of another person, usually dead, and the succession, therefore, moved seamlessly from one generation to the next in ways that made it possible to identify a rightful heir to a throne without there having to be an argument or a conflict over who was entitled to inherit the throne. And it was this notion of representation I gradually came to see was very, very important in thinking about the way in which the French monarchy worked, and very, very important also for thinking about the historical and the political thought of this chap, Charles-Louis de Zorandas, Baron de Montesquieu, who published in 1748 this famous book which came to be called The Spirit of Laws, or The Spirit of the Laws, as it is, I think, mistakenly called in English translation, but I won't get agitated about that. Well, the second one was this term or concept called science sociale, social science. And the interest for me was that it didn't mean what it has come to mean, because it had very much more to do with thinking about majority rule and how it is possible for 51% to be in some way or another decisive and be legitimate over 49%. And sometimes, as we have seen in relation to Mr. Trump, and the elections in the United States and elections in many, many parts of the world, majorities and minorities in electoral systems don't necessarily agree that this is what the outcome is. And this is what science sociale was originally coined to refer to by the person who coined the term in more or less the first place. This chap called Emmanuel-Joseph Sieyès, who used it and then dropped it, but he used it in this very now unusual way of thinking that, you know, it's a kind of knowledge that enables us to understand how it might be possible for majorities and minorities to coexist under democratic and electoral politics. So that's the second thing. The third thing is a term invented by somebody called Étienne Bonneau de Condillac, and the term is réalisation. Realization, turning something which is abstract and spiritual, let's say, mental, into something which purports to have a real existence, such as the idea of justice or equality or Michael. And there are many Michaels in this discussion, but each of them seems to have some distinctive attribute which singles them out from all the other Michaels. And something about these qualities seem to be more determinate than they might appear to be. How? Why? And quite a lot of subsequent thinking arose from this now forgotten way of thinking about reality and realization. So those are the three things that I think have been of interest to me and might even be of interest to other people too.
Thank you, Mike. I think I might draw you back to the beginning of your academic career when you worked on the urban trades in 18th century France. Your first book investigated the meaning of the work done by journeyman hatters in 18th century Paris, Lyon and Marseille. Your next book, Work and Wages, published by Cambridge in 1989, examined the urban trades as such, with special attention paid to the adjudication of disputes between master artisans and journeymen. Why should we remember the world, the now entirely vanished world, of the urban artisan? And how does your view of the artisan differ from that of, say, Eric Hobsbawm, who in his book Primitive Rebels called journeymen, and I quote, the most modern an advanced section of the labouring poor, and the most likely to adopt new ideologies, generally variants of Jacobinism?
Well, the way in which I went about this was the product of a set of accidents which helped me see that the vanished world, as you described it, was not quite as invisible or as part of the past as it, in that historiography, was made to appear, because I came to discover that an awful lot of the life of the 18th century urban trades took place under the aegis of the law, and an awful lot of what appeared to be the distinctively artisanal culture, values of a certain way of life or a certain set of trades, was just part of the idiom of the law as it existed within the political system as a whole. So there was a legal side to artisanal activity, artisanal life, that was not apparent in this historiography. And there was also a different kind of set of protagonists as against this historiography, because I accidentally came across some sources which enabled me to identify how these trades worked, and I discovered that most of the people who worked in the urban trades in France in the 18th century were young single men usually aged between about 14 and 20, 21, something like that. They didn't work for very long because in the main they would inherit property or they would marry somebody's daughter or niece, and they would acquire a capacity to set themselves up in a trade in their own right. So working for wages in this respect was not, as it now is, something that you do all your life. After a certain period of time, for most of these people, some of them, of course, did work for wages all their life, but most of them didn't. So it was a different kind of world. It was a world in which, in a certain sort of sense, migrants and people on their way to setting themselves up in one kind of activity or another were doing what still obtains in many, many parts of the world, even, it might be said, in Cambridge for many people. So it was a matter of a different set of values, a different set of expectations, and a different type of structure from those that I encountered in the work of people like Eric Hobsbawm, who took journeymen to be a kind of proto-proletariat. And my thought was that these were not proto-proletarians because they were not proletarians in any identifiable sense.
The next question I'd like to ask you, Mike, concerns capitalism and commercial society. So in the earlier work we have been discussing, capitalism is little mentioned next to the division of labour, natural rights, and the rhetoric of litigation. Last year, however, you published a short book, Capitalism, the Story Behind the Word, in which you take care to distinguish capitalism from the older concept of commercial society, and to draw out some of the implications of this difference for our understanding of modern politics. What things had to come into view for you as a historian so that you could be precise about capitalism?
Something to do with public debt, I would say, because the initial surprise that I had when I first encountered the word capitalism was that it had rather more to do with people who lent money to states rather than people who owned property which produced profits and was involved in the production of commodities. So capitalism in that sense, and I do emphasise the ism side of the word rather than the capital or the capitalist, because those two terms are very well known, widely used, and had nothing at all to do with the word or the concept of capitalism. Capitalism was a late 18th, early 19th century French word that was used in the context initially of thinking about relations between states and the degree to which financial resources that states had at their disposal would equip them with the capacity to either fight wars for a longer period of time or draw upon a greater range of resources and in one sense or another be able to exercise power and influence because, as Frederick the Great put it, the state that has the deepest pocket rather than the largest army will be the one that ultimately triumphs. So it's a, capitalisme was a word that was used initially to refer to war finance and the possible further consequences of the existence of public debt, both domestically and internationally, and became associated with Belgium's secession from the Netherlands, or the United Provinces of the Netherlands, in 1830. Don't worry, somebody wrote at that time about the Belgians, because they will soon have to obey the imperatives of the Dutch, because the Dutch have the deepest pockets and the greatest financial resources, and that will bend their economy in a direction that they wouldn't otherwise have chosen, but they'll have to do it. So that's the context in which I began to think about this capitalism. It then turned into a rather more complicated discussion about the degree to which state finance and public debt could be used to offset some of the more divisive effects of the division of labour. And so the question was, to what extent is capitalism a problem or a solution to social divisions and inequality? So it's a shift of focus, in a sense.
Let's follow up on this theme of public credit and public debt in the context of the French Revolution, which you've written several books about, including Before the Deluge and Sans Culottes, both published with Princeton in 2007 and 2008, respectively. Both, as I said, our studies of the French Revolution both revolve around the subject of public debt. Let's start with Sans Culottes, even though it was published after the Deluge. And here in the introduction, you make clear that your focus on 18th century debates about public debt is in and of itself a historiographical intervention. And you say the aim of the book is, I quote, to open up a way towards the real political history of the French Revolution. So can you tell us why such a way didn't exist before and how the book is trying to create it?
I suppose because I would claim that quite a lot of the historians of the French Revolution didn't pay very much attention to the degree to which the whole debt question was pretty central to the parts of Sieyès that are very well known and very widely registered, namely the assertion of the sovereignty of the Third Estate or the French nation, and the degree to which Sieyès's assertion of the sovereignty of the Third Estate or the French nation was a kind of counterpart to the concern that he and many other people voiced that, as had been the case in earlier parts of the 18th century, the solution to financial problems was usually a debt default. And the solution that didn't happen in 1789 was a debt default. So what made the revolution of 1789 rather unusual wasn't so much that there were claims about rights or claims about the tax burden or claims about representation, but this rather strange occurrence in which a government which had the power to default on its debts, for one reason or another, possibly just because of a certain kind of indecisive ruler, decided to reconvene something that hadn't existed for nearly 200 years, the French Estates General, and the rest followed from that, so that I'm trying to, in presenting what I did in that book, suggest that there's a dimension to the politics of the French Revolution which has fallen out of the picture. The aim of the book was to try and put it back into the picture, and by doing so, to suggest that once it was back in the picture, then the politics would look rather different, because the unusual thing about the French Revolution was that it entailed a national debt rather than the absence of a debt. And the politics of managing a national debt were not particularly in France all that easy to identify. And many people in the 18th century in Britain, where there was, of course, a very strong tradition of managing a national debt, were inclined to argue that, well, sooner or later the party would be over. Sooner or later it wouldn't be possible to manage the politics of a debt and wouldn't be possible to do so on the kind of premises of British political life. So the question was then, if you were going to manage a national debt in France, and if it looked as if the British solution was relatively impermanent, what alternative might there be? And that's where the story gets interesting, because they did, as we know, think that there should be an alternative, and they did try to establish one which was not particularly British, or for that matter particularly American, but in some way or another was connected to a way of thinking about, well, either not having a debt at all and gradually eliminating it, or finding a way of managing it on non-British principles, which is what ultimately I think Sieyès and the people who knew his thought tried to do. And that brought, you could say, a range of concerns that hadn't really been in existence either in France or in Britain onto the political agenda much more fully than might otherwise have been the case. So it was a kind of gamble, in a sense, that having a debt was dangerous, not having a debt was equally dangerous. So there had to be a way of finding a solution to the problem of having a debt that would be less dangerous. And it turns out, I think, that the person who provided some inspiration for this was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, which is a bit of a surprise as well, because we don't frequently associate Rousseau with public credit, certainly not with endorsing public credit. But Rousseau, in a certain kind of sense, did do so.
As you say, Sans-Culotte focuses mostly on Rousseau, whereas The Deluge is a study, in essence, of the political thought of Emmanuel Sieyès. And I wonder how you think these two thinkers relate to one another, because, as you say, they seem to be interested in more or less the same problem. And so I wonder if you think there is a way in which the kind of thinking about it evolves between Rousseau and Sieyès. And then related to that, I wonder how you connect this history of political thinking to the larger history of the French Revolution, and what you're trying to say about how political ideas shaped the revolution itself.
Well, let's try going back to this notion of representation, because the notion of representation was pretty important, first of all, to Montesquieu, as I think I tried to suggest, that there was a way of thinking about the royal succession which relied on the notion of representation and the overlap between the inheritance of property and the inheritance of thrones. And so there was something interesting about the kind of political system that Montesquieu identified, insofar as it consisted of two bits, a sovereign and then a government made up of a number of subordinate, dependent and intermediate powers, of which Montesquieu said the most natural is a nobility. Now, nobody thought this was a tremendously good idea, but quite a lot of people, I think, did notice that there were two bits. And if you could find a way of having the two bits without having the inheritance and the inequality, then it might be worth thinking about. And this is what Rousseau, I think, suggested was possible to Sieyès, partly by thinking about the notion of representation in a very different way, insofar as with Rousseau, the notion of representation has, first of all, to do with government rather than sovereignty, and the idea that the important thing in political life, appearances notwithstanding, but consonant with the thought of Montesquieu, is government, because government for Rousseau is the representative between the sovereign, who are you and me and everybody else, and the subjects, namely each of us individually. So the prime intermediate power, if you like, in any political society for Rousseau is government. And a great deal of Rousseau's interest lay in thinking about the relationship between government and sovereignty, which is quite hard to work out, but Rousseau did work it out, I think. He didn't write a treatise about the relationship. I mean, I suppose he did. It's called The Social Contract. It's quite hard to pull out what Rousseau had in mind in thinking about the relationship between sovereignty and government from The Social Contract. You can find quite a lot of it in the parts that deal with the government of the Roman Republic in The Social Contract. But you can also find quite a lot more in the book that Rousseau wrote for the Poles, The Considerations on the Government of Poland, in which he set out quite an elaborate way of thinking about how governments will be elected by a democracy, but the democracy will never be one single unit, one moment in time in which everybody at a particular moment elects the whole system of government. It will happen piecemeal, step by step, by way of, again, a number of different entities and units. And it's that idea which I think went into Sieyès' idea of both representation and the relationship between government and sovereignty. And Sieyès had this rather, again, neglected emphasis on thinking about redrafting the whole territorial division of France, creating a set of units which would be compatible with the distinction between government and sovereignty, dividing France into 83 departments, and making each of these departments have its own particular system of government. And on the strength of this, creating an electoral system in which elections would happen step by step over 1, 2, 3 years, in which people who are elected to one level of the system would then become the electorate for the elections to the next level of the system. So there would be what Sieyès, or what Rousseau, in fact, called a system of gradated promotion, which would give rise to the formation of a government. And Sieyès extended this a little bit by emphasizing the degree to which representation applies not just to inheritance and not just to the election of governments, but to the division of labor itself. There's a way by which the representation exists in any complicated society as either single or unitary. Public and private is what, you know, if I buy something from you, then in a certain sense you're acting as my representative because you're providing me with something that I wouldn't otherwise be able to obtain all by myself. But if we're all in some way or another dependent upon courts of law or central banks or other public institutions, then these institutions also represent us, but in a different kind of way from the way in which individuals might represent us. So there are two kinds of representation involved in any elaborate society, public and private representation, and a certain kind of set of constitutional arrangements might be compatible with this. That's, roughly speaking, the kind of Rousseau-Sieyès idea of what the French Revolution was supposed to deliver. It wasn't going to deliver very much, very quickly, because the whole idea was to avoid conflict and to find a way of managing a transition from the old regime to the new regime, if you like, but to do so step by step. And many people thought this is crazy because, you know, people have to eat, people have to enjoy what they need now because babies will be born, other people will be fall ill, hospitals will need to be built, etc. and so forth. So you can't subordinate people's real life needs to some set of abstract constitutional principles. Better to get things done right. But of course, the more you try to get things done right quickly, the more difficult it may become to manage your finances. And that's where the French Revolution sort of got complicated.
In your latest book, After Kant, The Romans, the Germans and the Moderns, which was published by Princeton earlier this year, you bring together quite a few of the themes that have come up in this conversation: the division of labor, public debt, human autonomy, private and public, Roman law, Christian theology. But they are embedded in and sort of modulated through debates about the philosophy of history from the 18th century through to the 20th. So can you explain why it is history, why it is debates about what history is and how it unfolds that united all of these fields of human inquiry into one big story that you tell in the book?
People noticed that in his essay on the idea of a universal history from a cosmopolitan point of view by Immanuel Kant, that Kant said something which was rather shocking, that history exists for, everybody who happens to be living at the end of history, because all those who have lived in the course of history unfolding will simply be contributing to the benefits, the welfare, the well-being of those remote humans living at the end of time. And they thought, this is crazy. How can it possibly be the case that, you know, you think about the future and you think that the future is, which was the point of Kant's essay, you think that the future is going to turn out to be better than the present and considerably better than the past. How can you think about justice when it looks to be the case that history is delivering injustice consistently and comprehensively and scandalously, you could say? And many, many of Kant's readers in Germany and in France, most famously, I suppose, Schiller. Schiller was not hostile to Kant. He rather thought this was tremendous, but he thought it can't be right. And the same applies to some of the people who really didn't like Kant all that much, like Herder or Jacobi, or some of the more spiritually oriented and Christian of Kant's contemporaries. They all registered that there was something pretty weird about this sort of claim, and they also registered that it had something as well to do with Rousseau and Rousseau's claims about the only thing you can say about humanity is that it changes, that it's people make things up, not just in an imaginative sort of sense, but the consequences of their imaginations are all too real and all too durable. So how can you make sense of history, if at all? How could you make sense, particularly if you happen to be a Christian, as many Germans, French people, Brits even, in the late 18th century? What's the point of the creation if the point of the creation is a sort of bad joke on humanity, the thing that's been created? And that's, I think, the question which motivated many of the people about whom this book has been written, and it raises a bit of a question. You know, you can, of course, fold your arms and say, well, things happen, and that's just all there is to say. And maybe that is all there is to say. But if you want to say, well, we do register that we live in time, and time has some sort of bearing on the lives that we lead and the values that we have, and the way that what was once there can still, in some way or another, shape our lives, such as the law or the state or currencies. How do we think our way through these different dimensions of time? That time delivers injustice, but time seems to be the only thing we've got it available to us. And the question is how you can articulate the durable and the transitory in ways that seem to be rather more compatible with the idea of justice and getting it right, not just at the end of time, but here and now, in ways that might make things manageable. Now, that's sort of what the book was trying to address.
On this point about justice and getting things right in the here and now, I want to ask a question about the pedagogical value of history, and especially the history of political thought. So one might say that some people, for example, the artisans of 18th century Paris, did not need to read Rousseau to learn about slavery and freedom, dependence and independence, natural rights and legal obligation. I want to ask, can the study of the history of political thought amount to a political education? Ought it to be that?
Well, what can I say? I think we use words, and we usually don't terribly much use them very well, and we don't need to read many books to see that sometimes the words that we use in talking about things aren't terribly clear and terribly easy to identify. So it's an endless process of clarification, and I don't think there's anything terribly special about Rousseau or Kant or any other such set of observations about some of the terminology that we use. Sometimes they throw light on things in ways that open things up. Sometimes other things, such as what somebody might say or what some institution might achieve or what some piece of history might leave behind, will have a comparable consequence. So I wouldn't be inclined to single out a particular thinker or a particular name or a particular text and say, You know, either everything is there or it's not. Nothing works like that as far as I've ever been able to notice. Things are very much more fluid and porous and permeable. And what historians, I think, try to do is try to indicate what gives rise to the permeability or what produces the porosity, what makes it possible for this way of saying things or doing things to be the one that counted in certain kinds of ways then and there for those people in those conditions. So there isn't, in that sort of sense, a kind of recipe that is embedded in studying the history of political ideas that is unavailable elsewhere. It is just a matter of being curious, I think, and thinking about why strange things happen most of the time, and why most of the things that do happen are very frequently rather more strange than people expect. That's where history comes in.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Shalosa, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Look out for the next episode on our social media feeds. Goodbye for now. We'll be right back.